I don't think it's a Dutch thing, but yeah, Vasilis kind of infected me with building clocks.
Yeah, and I do have a flamethrower as well, which...
Yes, which you didn't have on stage for obvious reasons.
Unfortunately.
So somehow there are issues with well, insurance, I think. And
yeah, Germans are so so funless.
Yeah.
Working Draft Revision 712. Wir haben heute eine besondere Episode, weil wir nämlich einen nicht deutschsprachigen Gast haben und darum werden wir jetzt direkt ins Englische wechseln. Hello and welcome to the Working Draft Podcast. We are three folks today from the team. There's Hans. Hello, Hans.
Hallo.
Then there's me, Shep, and that means that we have a guest, and that's Niels Lehnherr. Hello, Niels.
Hi there.
Hi, Niels.
Thanks for joining. Thanks for being here. So you've been a guest on our podcast twice already, but that's like really long time ago. The first time was 10 years ago where we talked about open device labs and with browsers. And the second time was 8 years ago where we talked about web Bluetooth and web USB. So I think most of our listeners don't know you or don't remember you. So maybe you can just introduce yourself as if you were here for the first time.
All right. So hi, I'm Niels, Niels Lehnherr, and I am a web developer from the Netherlands. As a day job, I build software for hair salons, like appointment booking software and point of sale systems. And it's all based on the web because I just love the web. I've been playing with the web since 1993. Playing with web standards and new technologies ever since.
Yeah, so people might know you from the HTML5 test.com website, which you built. So as you said, you were interested in all kinds of like APIs and things that the browser offers. And at a certain point in time, you just decided to like write a big test suite that tests for all kinds of features, and browsers would score on a scale of 100 or something, or no, it was just an open scale.
Yeah, it was kind of like a growing scale. It started with 100 and ended up with 555 because HTML5. It was kind of like a fun project for a while. Nowadays it's kind of obsolete, and I don't maintain it anymore because HTML5 is, HTML5 was a success. Everybody uses it. And when I started it, it was kind of still in an era where HTML5 was the future. And I was trying to get browsers to implement the new features, and adding a little bit of gamification just helped. Because browsers wanted to score high on the test, so they implemented features that they, didn't plan on implementing, or they in some cases, browser vendors started directing more resources to the team to implement HTML5 features. But that's now not the case anymore. It's just looking back, seeing all those standards on the test, and some of them didn't make it. Some of them have been changed so much since then, so it's not that useful anymore.
No, but it really did its job back then. So it really motivated the browser makers, and it was also a good tool to like check if something is supported on a browser, because I think back in the days we didn't have like all these platforms like Can I Use and MDN, the compatibility data stuff. So yeah, that was really cool. It fulfilled its mission. Yeah, and as I already pointed out, the other two visits where you were with us were also about like browsers and the differences in browsers, and also like new APIs like Web Bluetooth and Web USB, which are still kind of unusual nowadays. Mostly, I guess, because people don't have that many use cases, and also not all browsers implement them. So that's a kind of an evergreen episode that we will link to in our show notes for our listeners to listen to as well. And last time we met was 2 weeks ago in Düsseldorf at the Beyond Telerun conference, which we all three used to attend every year, I'd say. So
yep.
We're always returning because it's such a fantastic conference. So maybe we can do like a little like a recap of like our impressions from the conference. Mm. And then we'll also talk about like tinkering with in the browser, because you, Niels, you gave a talk, you were in the lineup of Beyond Telerun, and you gave a really, really nice talk on the first day about all kinds of tinkering. So that's the plan.
All right.
I think this game that you showed, like CSS-based Doom playing, that's definitely something I look forward and learning more about, because that was awesome. But we will come to that in a second. I think, so for me, I had a little break a couple of years ago, not attending Beyond for, let's say, 2 years or so. But I have been there now for a couple of events. And for me, it's always this, like meeting people. We always talked about this in like before the conference as well, right? You meet a lot of people that you know. It's like the class trip, the yearly one to Düsseldorf, where everybody meets. But I got this sentiment this time that lots of people that I talked to had in mind, industry is currently a little bit flat, like not too much investment happening. And some people were a little bit not
depressed,
frustrated.
Kind of a bit depressed, yeah.
Depressed, yeah, yeah. Did you have that feeling as well?
It's not just at Beyond Telerun, but basically every conference I go to lately, it's been about AI and about how AI is can be a good thing for an industry, but also I'm not going to say a danger to the industry, but it's going to complicate our lives with a lot of slop, and it's going to somehow it kind of makes us feel like we're not really I don't know how to put it. It feels like we have less worth as developers, because we could just let the client ask AI to build something, and where does that leave us as developers or designers? Mm. And that kind of is like always in the back of my mind when I go to these conferences, and I think with a lot of other people as well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, let's not dig into that whole like what AI does to our jobs, right? Yeah, it definitely changes a lot, and you can see it in the industry, obviously. I found it interesting to hear so many like the negative sentiments about AI in general, right? But I think it's because we come from this point where software engineers were the ones that were, you know, the holy cow somehow, right? And everybody wanted to have the best developers, and hiring was hard, and so on and so forth. And now the market has turned, the view has shifted from the companies. But what I found interesting, Oliver Reichenstein, he put it in the first, I think it was the first talk on the first day, where he talked about his IA writer, a minimalistic tool, and how AI development, so to say, has helped him to grow his tool, not by using AI to like work on it, but rather people trying to do the exact same product, and then clients don't buy these, like, let's say, copy products, copycats, but they rather come back to the original tool and buy that one. And I heard this story not once, but twice. Also, another person told me about it, that they had the same experience within their tool. And I found that fascinating, because that shows, like, what's the, like, the other side of things, so to say, if you will, when it comes to AI engineering. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the other reason why it is a topic is that at Beyond Telerant you have a lot of creative folks, and creative professions are also, like, under menace from AI. But my point of view is that, sure, you can use AI, but, like, if you want to, like, the really cool stuff, you still, like, the things that were shown on stage are things that are kind of, that you don't get when you ask AI. You get, like, nice mainstream stuff, but that's also the nice thing about Beyond Telerant, that it's totally not mainstream. So it's the least mainstream tech conference that I know, where always, like, there's always folks and presentations on stage that blow your mind with things that are being done and shown that you would not see at any other conference in the world, I'd say.
Yeah.
Definitely. And it's a nice mix between creativity and technology. So there's creative conferences where you have, like, a lot of creative folks, and then there's tech conferences, but, like, this mix is really unique, I'd say, or almost unique. So I think there's, like, a few others, maybe FITC in Canada, and then Half Stack Conference, kind of, maybe.
Where, yeah, you maybe. Also,
yeah, sometimes speak, Niels. Yeah. So it was, like, so good to see these talks, to get inspired, to see what folks come up with. On the first day, like, Niels, you blew all our minds.
Yeah.
On the second day, there was André Michel, who opened the day with a digital signal processor digital signal processing SDK that he built, that ran in the browser, that everybody can use to build products. And he showed all kinds of ways to put it to practice. And they were all fantastic. And at the end, there was even Bastian Ahlgeier, the creator of the Kirby CMS, that volunteered to come on stage with an electric guitar that was connected to the computer, or to Andre's computer. And then he did, like, live effects. And that was just a great opening of the day. And then later there was James White, someone that I've seen once at FITC in Amsterdam, and that I've, like, loved the art. He does 80s synthwave style illustrations, he loves, like, the old 80s comics and He-Man stuff and what else we had, and he just did a fantastic presentation performance wise and so, yeah, he just blew my mind as well. Yeah, but as I said, you did a presentation, and not just any presentation. It was, like, really, really, really cool, because you kind of, like, a best of your recent tinkering that you do at home on all kinds of weird things, and also things that you would probably not connect with browsers and computers, kind of, or maybe computers, but not, like, with browsers. So, yeah, so we thought we could talk about your projects and also, like, the your way to get into these projects and, like, what is your approach. And I think you opened the talk with a clock. So, yeah. So you are, like, a big clock nerd, which maybe you got from Vasilis, or because Vasilis van Giemant is also, like, a clock nerd. Maybe Dutch folks are all clock nerds. I don't know.
Well, I don't think it's a Dutch thing, but yeah, Vasilis kind of infected me with building clocks. A while ago, he built like this gradient clock on a Raspberry Pi with a touchscreen, and I loved that so much that I wanted to build a clock myself as well. But one of the things his clock had was a square screen, and I think clocks should be round. So I went looking for a round touchscreen, and well, you can buy one. That's not an issue. So I bought one and a Raspberry Pi, and I got Chrome working on it without like the browser UI, so it's running full screen. And then I started building a clock, and then I thought, well, this is boring.
Well, maybe I can already ask a question. So you said it's like easy to get like a round touch screen, but so for me it would be like, I don't know, where would I look for a round touch screen? Would I find it on Amazon or
probably Amazon, okay. or just like any of the major electronics companies. I think I bought one on AliExpress, which is and then it takes a couple of weeks to get there, and it just works. So the screen I had, you can basically bolt a Raspberry Pi on the back of it, and it's like a full computer, and you can run Chrome on it, and you can basically do anything with it.
So the browser is basically the enabler for like the runtime where you can do anything. Like you don't.
Yeah, you could build native applications as well, but I built everything in the web, so.
Yeah, because
the first
you're a
thing
web developer.
I did was just run Chrome on it, or you could go on Firefox on it, whatever. And then you can build whatever you want. For me, there was a clock, and the thing I started out with was that I wanted just to build a clock, but that's not that much of a challenge. And I started thinking, what can I do with this clock? And all kinds of just ideas popped up, and in the end it turned into a clock that doesn't tell the time. it kind of refuses to tell the correct time.
So it's a stubborn clock.
A stubborn clock, a bad clock. And one of the things it does, for example, if you have summertime or winter time, it just doesn't understand that, and it will change the time for you, but maybe in the wrong direction. And sometimes it will just forget to reset the clock at midnight, so it will continue counting like 24, 25, 26, 27, and so on. And there's all kinds of just little quirks that makes it really difficult to tell the time.
And how do you come up with these? Is it like under the shower, or when it's summertime and time to change all the clocks, you're like, oh, wait, that's a nice thing to...
It's basically, I've built it over the last 2 years or something, well, maybe a year and a half. And every time I come up with something that I think is weird and counterintuitive, I put it in the clock. And one of the last projects I did was add gravity to the clock. So whatever you see on screen, like the hands of the clock, usually you just draw that. But what I did is basically put the hands into a full box 2D gravity simulation with motors that run the clock. And it's way too complicated for just a clock. But then you can do fun stuff use a touchscreen to flick the hands, and they move around the pivot point of the clock. And if you shake the clock, there's an accelerometer that picks up the position of the clock in space. And if you shake it, it detects that. And then the hands drop down. And if you flick the hands too hard, they just launch into the edges of the screen and bounce off and fall on the floor, and
all kinds of stuff like that, which is totally not useful, but it's so much fun to play with and so much fun to create. And that is kind of the thing with my projects, is that I just want to have fun with these projects, with the web, with web technology. And just making something that is totally ridiculous is so much fun.
Yeah. Think it's these small things that really draw the attention to a project like this, right? If you would have just shown on stage, this is a clock, I did it with some web stuff, whatever, right? People wouldn't care too much. But it's because of like effects, like you can just like push away one of the hands. That's really cool. I wonder, like, you mentioned a couple of things when it comes to technology, but how do you set up a project like this? You got the Chrome running, okay, but then really, like, what are you using libraries for that?
Well, I did use a library for the Gravity. It is like a JavaScript clone of Box2D, which basically you can set up motors and gravity and it'll just push out all the coordinates that you need to draw on screen. But other than that, it's just custom code that is basically the hands are just, in this case, SVG. And they are positions using using CSS. It's not that difficult. It's just an HTML file with some JavaScript in. That's it. Whenever I work on the clock, I kind of do it old style, like I SSH into the clock and then write my code just on the clock, and it runs a small web server that then serves the HTML to the browser, and I can just refresh the page and the new updated clock runs. It's really a hobby project, and it's designed to the development really feels like you're
in a laboratory.
Laboratory. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not anything you would use in a professional environment. No.
Yeah. So you have no CI/CD pipeline that runs on every push and these kind of things. Yeah.
No, it's just me and HTML and JavaScript and
I totally understand this for the clock, right? Okay, you can manage it that way. Probably just have it wired together in some form or another, and then it needs to load kind of fast and like React. But you also have other projects where, from what I've seen, like the lasers, for example, or the accelerator, I think it's called, like these seem a little bit more complex. Is that correct?
One of the projects I showed at Beyond Teledont was using CSS and SVG to draw images on a 1980s oscilloscope. And that kind of started also with my obsession with clocks, because I wanted to create a clock using lasers. But I didn't have a laser projector. And they are pretty expensive, so I kind of figured, well, as a geek that was into electronics like 20 years ago, I've always wanted to have an oscilloscope, and I figured, well, that kind of works in the same way. It doesn't, but it on a very basic level, it kind of works in the same way. You have like in an oscilloscope, you have this electron beam that you can steer around. And I figured I could probably connect that to the web on some level. And then I can draw shapes. And if I can draw shapes, I can draw a clock. And the aesthetic of having a clock on an oscilloscope, it's like 1980s lab equipment. That is... I love that. It makes you feel like you're in the lab of a mad professor. And it's not very energy efficient to use as a clock. And
There are other reasons why you don't want to have it running continuously, but I just started playing with it and also very, very basic way to just generate a signal that the oscilloscope can pick up. And
so what is an oscilloscope?
An oscilloscope is basically it's like lab equipment that you can use to visualize signals, either analog signals like audio or digital signals.
It's like an instrument with like a lot of knobs and things, and then there's like a kind of like a cathode ray tube screen.
Yeah, you have like a CRT tube in there that shoots an electron beam if people are familiar with this kind of technology, it's probably you've seen something like a heart rate monitor where see the ECG wave just on the screen, just it looks like that. And you can use it for that as well. But it's really just for visualizing any electrical signal. So you use it a lot in electronics to measure things and see the output of components and stuff like that. So what I am using it for is totally ridiculous because nobody wants to see a clock on an oscilloscope. That's not what they're for. But I figured that from a web page, you can basically generate a signal that the oscilloscope can understand. And you can use like web audio for that. With web audio, you have a left channel and a right channel. And if you generate a signal for the left channel and a signal for the right channel, you can basically put that straight into the oscilloscope and steer the beam on the X and Y axis.
Mm-hmm. So you map one channel to one axis, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the starting idea, and then math got involved, and I had to do a whole refresher course of my high school math, and I basically built something that you can generate an arbitrary signal and output it to the oscilloscope. And I'm using SVG for that and CSS. So you can basically draw shapes using SVG, like the clock face and hands. You can animate them using CSS. And then every, like, say 25 or 30 times a second, you sample the geometry of the shapes. There's APIs for that. And you turn that into an audio wave. And that audio wave is directed to the oscilloscope. And then you get a picture on the screen.
Yeah, nice.
And technology-wise, it's actually really, really simple because the core wave generation is maybe like 10 or 15 lines of JavaScript code.
Mm-hmm. I guess the most complicated part was really like doing the math of like decomposing the current SVG and CSS and like turning that into.
Not even that. Okay. That's also not really that difficult because there's APIs for. If you inject the SVG in the DOM, you can basically use an API to get all the elements. And for every element, you get the length of the path. There's an API for that. And then you determine, I have this length. Then I should sample the path this many times to get a reasonable approximation of the shape. And then you call an API, get point at length, and they get like the X and the Y coordinates of the shape at that length of the path. Mm-hmm. So it's not that difficult. The only difficult part is that in the DOM, you can have CSS transforms. And those are not in the get point at path of a get point of length output.
Yeah. So they don't the element is always like on its starting position.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like so you need to get the transformation matrix and then do some math to get the actual mm-hmm. points. But that wasn't really the hard part. In its core, that project is not that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe
also something where like AI can like kind of help. Like if you need to like, hey, how can I like get the matrices and how can I like, do I need to like multiply my coordinates to get like the real ones? I guess so. I would probably give it a try.
Yeah, you can probably do that. Yeah. It's all web APIs that are not really new. It's been there for years. So AI probably knows a lot about how to do that. Mm-hmm. But the only problem I had, I did use AI for a couple of things, not this one, but for example, if you build the clock, that weird clock that I talked about, if you ask AI to implement like a new quirk or something, that works, but it also sees like all the errors you made, the deliberate errors you made because you want the clock to be weird and not show the time.
Yeah.
But it'll just fix that for you. And then you have a working clock again and you don't want that.
Yeah. 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 Sure. That's AI is always tries to like do things like the right way in air quotes. Yeah.
And yeah, the projects I do are not how you should do things. It's not the right way. It's just me having fun and using technology in a different way than you expect, and using AI for that is a challenge, and for some of the things I don't mind using AI, but for a lot of the joy I get out of these projects is just coding myself.
Yep.
And
that's
sure
also where you learn most, like I'd say.
Yeah.
So.
And of course, if I don't understand something about, I want to achieve a certain goal, I know where I want to go. And that's the important part. But I don't know quite how to get there. Then you can ask AI, sure. And it'll maybe offer a solution for you. And then you can just build it yourself again.
So yeah, that's always like it's like a like all the with these puzzles where sometimes you get like hints. So that's also how I like to use them. Give me a hint, like how could I approach this, and then it tells me, yeah, that's how I would do it, and then I take over and like research and try things.
Yeah. Probably that's how smart people do it.
Right? Yeah,
just, you know, ask for. Yeah. Do the job.
But speaking of lights and lasers, so you also, I think you also had like these DMX lights on stage that you controlled with the browser, if I remember correctly, right?
That's correct. Yeah, one of the things I wanted to do like maybe like for the last 10 years already. So back in 2018, when I was on, I talked about controlling lights using Bluetooth.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of evolved from that. I wanted to control lights, like not small light bulbs or anything, but really big stage lights. And the protocol you use for that is DMX, which is like a 1980s protocol. It's relatively simple. It's basically you have like this array of 512 values and like light uses maybe three out of that big array, like for red, green, and blue. And that big array is shared among all the lights and it gets sent out every 40 times a second. And every light picks up its part of that array and then changes the lights based on the values it sees. And there is basically a USB to DMX dongle that you can use. And well, if it's a USB device, you can use web USB for that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did build is build a driver that translates a JavaScript array of 512 bytes into packets that are being sent to the DMX controller. And then when you change a value in the JavaScript array, a light changes.
Mm-hmm.
In its core, it's also very simple. It's not more than like 20 lines of code to do that.
Yeah. But I think the hard part is maybe the driver then in that case. So that sounds like a not web-based thing, but
maybe it's not a web-based thing. But the driver is also just JavaScript code that you have to take the input, the array, and then write packets, USB packets to the controller and use web USB for that. And it's...
Okay, so basically it's like a converter more than a drive, it's not a device driver, not a classic device driver.
It's like a JavaScript-based device driver.
Yeah, okay.
But the device is pretty sensible. You can just write data to it. It's really not that difficult.
Yeah.
I would say that pretty much every web developer can do that. If they just know how the device wants to receive the data, and like the web USB spec, the API isn't that difficult. You just have to learn a bit about how USB works.
Mm. Yeah, and it's like pretty low level.
Yeah, it's pretty low level. Yeah, but it's not difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I would say in my day job, actually building web applications, I deal with far more complicated stuff.
Yep. But also with web USB, right? Because you do these, you connect printers to like point of sale systems in hair salons and yeah. So
yeah. Yeah. That's where I learned how to do web USB stuff. So maybe the step to DMX Lite isn't that big because of that. But really, anybody that wants to do stuff like what I do could do that. I'm also just a web developer.
Yep. Yeah. You just need a little time at hand, and of course also like you need to shop the required equipment on Alibaba or AliExpress.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So how many DMX lights do you have in your household?
That's
just one.
So I have like 5 DMX lights, I think. Then I have a smoke machine as well.
Oh yeah, right. You also had the smoke machine on stage. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I do have a flamethrower as well, which
you didn't have on stage for obvious reasons.
Unfortunately,
so somehow there are issues with. Well, insurance, I think.
Germans are so so funless.
Yeah. I kind of get the idea why Mark didn't want to bring it on stage, because it was the second talk of the first day, and well, to burn the building down.
But it would have been nice if the flamethrower would have been like in the courtyard outside where everybody.
I could do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, cool. Yeah, right. These are also all DMX protocol controlled.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like the flamethrower is basically using two channels, like two values out of that 512 value array. And just set 2 bytes and you have a big fireball coming out of the device.
But how do you get these ideas? So okay, DMX lights, okay. Maybe also the smoke machine, because that's... but then flamethrowers, how?
Well, the flamethrower, that was... I wasn't supposed to get one. But I was on a train on the way to Beyond Tolerance in Berlin last November.
I was just browsing my phone, AliExpress, and all kinds of devices.
Like your next prey.
And I was just thinking, hey, that's a flamethrower. it's like a stage flamethrower that uses DMX. So it's really cheap, and I can just buy it. Just one tap of a button, and then
you slipped and clicked it.
And I don't know how it happened, but somehow I clicked it. I just had so much fun with the idea of having a flamethrower that I just had to do something with that. I just had to explain my wife.
I think she's used to your explanations nowadays, I guess.
Yeah, I can just say I need it for work.
Yeah, maybe it's not a good idea to start with the flamethrower, but once you've already tinkered with all kinds of things, then like later on you can bring the flamethrower.
Yeah. Then it's I kind of expected that I had a couple of weeks to prepare my wife that I bought a flamethrower.
Mm-hmm.
But it when I got back from the conference in Berlin, it was just sitting there on my coffee table.
Mm-hmm. And your wife was like, Niels, what is this again?
So my 11-year-old son,
he has probably a lot of fun with your stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he also helping you with these things nowadays?
Well, programming, not really. I don't think that's really his thing, mm-hmm. but lately he's gotten into soldering, like electronics, and
you built something for that too, right? If I remember correctly, didn't you?
I'm sorry.
Wasn't there something where you could or maybe I'm mixing it up then? If you're not coming to it, then probably I mix it up. Mm. Okay, not yet.
No. I could probably do something, but
yeah. So looking forward to everything you do in the future, of course. So, but one thing that you also showed, and I think you also showed it on the oscilloscope, was there's this kind of running joke nowadays that like you are required to try to get to run Doom on any device that kind of you get in your hands. And I think you also demonstrated Doom. I think you showed like Asteroids, the game.
Yeah.
Because you also like in the end, so you at the beginning you said you didn't want, like, you wanted a laser, but they were too expensive and all these kinds of things. And then you had went the detour over the oscilloscope and then the DMX lights and then the smoke machine flamethrowers. And then you also had a laser.
Yeah.
So you came around to buying the laser.
I did buy the laser because, yeah. Well, once you go with the flamethrower, where do you go from there? Well, lasers.
Of course.
Yeah, like I said, I wanted to build a clock with lasers originally. Those things are expensive, and I didn't even know if I could connect it to like a web page. And I did see a talk by Seb Lee Delisle like 10 years ago where he recreated the game Asteroids on a laser projector. And the way he did it was not from the browser, but I think using like C or Python. I'm not sure anymore. And that's fun, but I kind of want to do everything in the browser because that is what I know, and also because that is I love the web. And it took me a while to find the method to actually be able to draw figures on a laser projector using web technology.
So how, like, do you connect things to it?
Yeah, the laser projector basically talks in a protocol called ILDA,
And the missing part was, how do I generate ILDA from the browser? And luckily, there was also a company that sold like a USB dongle that translates, or that allows you to send coordinates to the dongle, and it then translates that into the proper ILDA protocol that the laser projector understands. And from then on, it was just sending out the right coordinates. And I started out with basically my oscilloscope project, which generates X, Y coordinates for steering the electron beam. And I basically tapped into that and then redirected those coordinates to the ILDA dongle, and within like 30 minutes I had a laser projector that worked like an oscilloscope.
Nice.
And everything I built on the oscilloscope I could also run on the laser projector.
Cool.
And one of the things I did build was like an JavaScript version of Asteroids. Well, the same game that Sepley Delisle recreated on the laser projector, and got that running on the scope first. And then when I connected the laser projector to it, I could just play Asteroids on the laser projector as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things that I started playing with was the like Doom on the oscilloscope.
Yeah. So that's basically the running joke. Trying to get to run Doom on anything.
That kind of started out as just a joke, because realistically you can't play Doom on an oscilloscope, because
at least not on an oscilloscope alone without help by some external device, right?
An oscilloscope is just visualizes things, so it's you need to have an input signal. So the project I did was basically generate that signal that the oscilloscope can visualize. And it can be any signal. So if I generate Doom, I'm playing Doom on the oscilloscope. And if I'm generating like Asteroids, I'm playing Asteroids. And if I'm generating like Chrome offline dinosaur game, I'm playing the Chrome offline dinosaor game. But I think Doom was kind of quite a challenge.
Yeah, especially since you can run Doom in the browser, so that exists. But that's just like an engine that uses HTML5 canvas. But what you need for your kinds of display devices is like real shapes, like not just one, like not a pixel, not just pixels in the canvas, but you like need different elements with shapes, with outlines.
For Doom, I needed to write a parser that takes the game file from Doom that contains all the maps, and basically extract those maps and then render it like a 3D scene, and basically just using lines, because the oscilloscope can only show lines. That got me into the 3D rendering, and I...
What's a rabbit hole?
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole. And it kind of was fun, but I'm also kind of glad that I finished it and I don't have to worry about that anymore, because it was... the end result is fun, but getting there, that was a lot of work, a lot of hard work. But in the end, I just had something that I could run around. I had a map in 3D on the oscilloscope, and I could just run around and not actual gameplay, because I figured that is too difficult. I don't want to bother, but just running around is fun enough.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into another rabbit hole that was, I have these maps. I know how to extract data from that game file, from the WAD file. I could do something else with that. I could basically render a Doom map in CSS using divs for everything. And on a div, you have a background image that's a texture, and you position them in 3D space using CSS 3D transforms. And that kind of happened after a conference in Brighton, and I had an extra day there, and I just started playing with that, and I had the data, so I figured, well, I could do something with that. In the end, I basically recreated the whole game Doom, including gameplay. And it's rendered completely in CSS because, well, you can. that is basically the only reason. So you can just go to a browser and go to csdoom.w2f and just play it. and it works. And the challenge for me was basically, how can I create this with as much CSS as possible? Because ultimately you have to use JavaScript as well. Because for the gameplay,
controlling where to move to and what the monsters do, like what the
that is basically all JavaScript, and you can't really get around that. But the challenge for myself was how to do as much as possible in CSS, and so I basically took the game Doom and split it into two, like half a CSS renderer and JavaScript game loop. And the CSS renderer is basically just divs. And if you have a door that moves upwards when it opens, that is a CSS animation. It's a CSS transition. And if you have like a fireball that is thrown by an enemy, that is basically an HTML element that is spawned, and it has a starting coordinates and it has end coordinates, and it has a CSS animation that basically moves the fireball from one set of coordinates to the other one.
That makes total sense, because it's like these fireballs never like change the trajectory once they so that's perfect for CSS animations.
And so there is basically so much is happening in CSS that some browsers have some issues with that. It's kind of pushing the boundaries of what browsers can do, and that's also fun, because that's an opportunity to optimize the browser.
So I think you or somebody like skeeted or tooted today that the Ladybird browser team just like did a CSS anchor positioning fix in that case to fix a bug that the Ladybird browser had with your game. So it's you're basically playing them again, like just in a more subtle way than with HTML5 test.
That was really fun to read. I would guess that CSS anchor positioning is useful enough without Doom. And you want to implement it in any case, but they want to implement it because they want to run CSS Doom. I didn't expect that.
That's nice.
But anchoring position is used for several things in the game, because for the position of the hand or the weapon, for example, that is if you run the original game, that's always in a fixed position. But the game in a browser, it changes size based on the size of the browser window. It's responsive. So you need to position the hand as well relative to like the heads-up display that is on the bottom of the screen. And if that wraps over two columns or two rows, or three rows if you have a very narrow screen, then the hand needs to move up.
Yep.
And otherwise it gets behind the head-up display. And that's one of the issues that the original developers of Doom never had to think about. But once you implement it in CSS, that's things you run into. And anchoring positioning was perfect for the job. You could do it in JavaScript as well, of course, but that would have ruined the
whole purpose of this experiment.
Yeah, and the same thing with basically you could do this 12, 15 years ago, because the basics of CSS Doom is just CSS 3D transforms, and that have been around since like 2012, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
So it's not really that innovative, but when I implemented it, I want to do as much as possible in CSS. And yes, for example, if you have the walls that are using CSS 3D transforms, you could calculate the values of the transforms in JavaScript. But I purposely don't. I just take the values from that game file, from the WAT file, and just set them as custom properties on every ball. And then I use CSS trigonometry functions to actually calculate the transforms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really like a stress test for modern CSS functions in that way.
Yeah, there's also like a few other tricks you applied. So for example, so you're reusing textures. Like there's a set of like textures that you use everywhere, but there's areas where there's like they are more lit than in other areas where they are more in the shadow. Yeah. And I think if I remember right from your Smashing conference jam session talk, you were using CSS filters to like increase and decrease brightness and these kind of things.
Yeah. So set the brightness of every sector, of every room. You basically set a custom property with the brightness. And that's all pre-calculated and also coming from the game file. So that's just...
But you also have like animations for flickering lights.
Yeah,
I think you also had these.
And that custom property is used to calculate a filter. And a filter is basically brightness. So you can change how dark the texture appears. And of course, because everything... can be animated nowadays with add property in CSS. You can basically animate that custom property, the brightness property, to get flicker effects or pulsating lights and stuff like that. In the original game, that was all just calculated by the game engine. And for CSS Doom, that is basically just setting a custom property and let CSS handle all of that stuff.
Yep. I think that's also a lot more performant because what you also explained is that I think that's also like the case with WebGL things, that when you have the impression that you move through a level, in fact, like the camera is still at its place, like it stays at its place. And what happens is that the engine takes everything around you and moves that like in the opposite way. So if you go forward, then it will take everything and move it like backwards and the other way around. And so for you looking at the screen, it looks like you are moving through it, but in reality, everything is moved around you.
That's the thing with CSS 3D transforms, is you don't have like a moving camera. So everything you see is how the scene is laid out. So if you want to simulate like moving through the scene, you have to transform everything around you. So if you go upstairs, for example, you move the whole world down.
Yep.
And if you go forwards, you move the whole world backwards. And that way it appears that you are moving, but it's actually the world moving around you. With CSS, that is really simple because so what I do is I have this container. It's like a div. And that container is the scene. And I place all of the walls and all of the floors and everything inside of the container, and they have CSS transforms relative to the container. And then when I apply a CSS transform on the container, everything moves. So I don't have to do any calculations at all to move around. Just set like 3 or 4 custom properties. Yep. That is the player position on the scene on the container.
Yeah, I guess that's like a big advantage of this tree structure that we have in websites, that we don't have to touch all the elements by themselves, but we can group them and then move the group.
Yes, yeah. And the renderer, the browser renderer, just puts that all together and just renders it like we want. And we don't need to worry about the complications of basically the rendering. It's just a fixed scene that we create, and then we transform the scene, the world around us, and that works really, really well. Except that the first level works really well, but the other levels are more complicated. Then you'll get into performance issues. Like, you'll have to render like 10,000 divs in a 3D space, and that really stresses the browser. And for example, in Chrome, there's actually an issue with that many divs. Not the divs itself. That's fine, but like every div gets a texture on the CPU for itself. And most of the textures are identical, like walls all have the same texture, but they don't, on the GPU, they don't share that texture. And in other browsers, they probably do that. They do share it. And on Chrome, every div gets their own GPU texture. And that basically breaks everything. So one of the things to make things more performant is to actually hide things that are not in view.
Mm-hmm.
So the world that is behind you, you can set just add hidden, the hidden attribute on it.
Does your implementation do that?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that is in JavaScript. Unfortunately, I wanted really to have that in CSS.
Did you try content visibility?
Yeah. You can do it in CSS, but you kind of need the if function for that.
Oh, okay.
And that's not really well supported yet.
Yeah.
I did implement it and it works. But with JavaScript you can optimize better.
Yeah.
So for now, I've done that in JavaScript. So everything that is behind you is hidden. So it doesn't add any stress to the GPU. And also there is, if you have a wall right in front of you, everything behind the wall is hidden. So instead of having to render 10,000 divs, you only have to render like 1,000.
Mm. Okay.
And that makes things already more manageable. And that is one of the optimizations I do in JavaScript, like I said, I really want to do as much as possible in CSS but not everything I want to do is possible.
It's possible
right now.
Yet. Yeah, but maybe like with these things appearing, as we've seen with the Ladybird browser.
Yeah.
Browser makers have a reason, and if it's just that they want to like see their browser be able to render these nice things, even if it's maybe like not on the priority for most people to be able to do that, sometimes it's like a personal thing. So
yeah. But even these performance optimizations, most people won't run into these, or most websites won't run into these performance issues.
Yeah.
But under the hood, if you optimize for CSS Doom, then every website will benefit from that, yep, even by a tiny bit, because the rendering just gets more efficient.
Yep.
I'm happy that browser are trying to, well, improve their rendering of CSS Doom, even though it's in itself, it probably isn't really a big priority for them to get CSS Doom running.
Yeah. But yeah, it just lays bare like the shortcomings of engines by pushing them. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to use, but that I couldn't yet, is like CSS random function.
Oh, yeah. It's just in Safari right now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I encountered was that I used this like stepped sprite animation. So, for example, if you have an enemy that is walking, you basically have like one big background image, and you change the background positioning. And
there's all movement phases are on the strip, and then you kind of move the strip to the right phase.
Yeah, you just, for example, if like the sprite is 60 pixels wide, you move the background image minus 60 and then minus 120, minus 180, and then back to zero. And you can use CSS animations for that. And standard, then they just move gradually, but you have a stepped function for that. So it basically steps from 0 to 60 in one step.
It just doesn't transition between the two positions anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's great. I used it all over the game. But when you have like 5 or 6 of soldiers running towards you, they are walking in step. They are all walking, marching towards you all at the same time.
Yeah.
Their feet move exactly the same.
Makes sense. Yeah.
That's really disturbing. And so what I do now is I basically set an animation delay, a negative animation delay. So the animation has started in the past. So they move not in step anymore. And if I had the CSS random function, that would be just so much easier.
Yep. Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know why it's like, I think in Safari it's there already for quite a while, at least a year, I'd say. But the other browsers don't make any, like, don't seem to make progress on that. Yeah, nice. And then you said you built everything out of divs. Some of them you had to like, because divs are always like quite rectangular, you had to like cut them with clip path and shape, I think.
Yeah. So with Doom, you have basically walls are in Doom are always squares. So walls translate really well to divs. You can basically create all the walls with just a div and then translate them into 3D space. But once you got to floors and ceilings, you have a problem because the floors and ceilings are not squares. And to solve that, you basically have to calculate a clip path. You have to take all the walls and their coordinates and basically recreate that shape. That is where a lot of math comes in, and clip path isn't that new, so it's not that. Once you get the coordinates, it's not that difficult. Getting the coordinates that's the difficult part of math. You can basically clip a div into a different shape and position that flat on the floor, and then you have your floor. The only issue I had with that traditional clip path were you had to do it with pixels.
or at least CSS, well, like pixels or mm-hmm. points or yeah. millimeters or whatever. Like, yeah. like you know, I want everything to be independent.
Yeah. So what you want is like something where, is it like that when you resize the browser, you want things to adapt or
yeah.
what?
Yeah. yeah. So I want to use percentages because the rendering details, I don't want to do that in JavaScript. I want the rendering details to be in CSS.
Yeah.
So if you have a clip path that is percentages, it will just adapt to however you use it.
And that's possible, I think, but really
and that's
new,
now possible
right?
with yeah. clip path shape.
Yeah.
And that is relatively new and I'm very happy that now just works. And that basically means that you don't have to do calculations in the CSS coordinate space in JavaScript. You can basically yeah. just generate the shape that you want and be that independent of the coordinate space that you use in CSS.
Yeah. Cool. And then you said you used divs everywhere.
Yeah.
But
except
there's one place.
There's one thing that's. Yeah, that kind of started out as a joke. And
yeah. We're waving Manuel Matuzovic also.
yeah. Yeah. A div is not a button.
A div is not a button. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So whenever you get to the end of the level, you have this button to, well, like a switch that you have to pull to get to end the level and get to the next one. And that is the only element that isn't a div, because that's a button. Because,
of course.
It's a button.
yeah, it needs to be semantic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I figured that if I can make that a button instead of a div, then everybody can make their websites with buttons.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So if Doom can do it, everybody can do it.
Yeah. So why are people doing it?
Yeah. Yeah, really nice. So fantastic projects, fantastic ideas, great execution, really hacky. I think so, although we've seen your talks, I think through this episode we learned quite a few more details which you like spared from at least the Beyond Tellerand talk, because yeah, so I think it's not that important for the crowd there to know all the nitty-gritty details, but yeah, it was nice to be able to dig a little bit deeper this time. Fantastic. So the next time people can see you talk will be also not like soon at CSS Day in Amsterdam, right?
Yeah, I'll give a talk called CSS Doom Lasers in Amsterdam at CSS Day in June, June 11th and 12th, I think. I'm just going to go there and just have fun, I think.
Yeah.
Talk about my oscilloscope projects and CSS Doom, of course, and I'll bring the laser projector as well to show some experiments.
So bring sunglasses, everyone.
Yeah, it's good. PPK, the organizer, basically told me I wasn't allowed to bring the flamethrower, so it will probably be safe.
Yeah, although you have to say it happens in a church. Maybe like flamethrowers in a church are also not like appropriate.
No. Earlier this year, one of the churches, historic church in Amsterdam, burned down, unfortunately. And
have you given a talk there?
No.
Okay.
that wasn't my doing, no.
Okay.
But yeah, it's probably not a good idea to bring a flamethrower.
No. Once we do like an open air conference, then we can do it. Maybe like in Verona in the arena or something.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody wants to see you or give your talk, then CSS Day would be like the, like at least for now, the last chance. I think ticket prices will also increase the day after this episode comes out. So people that are listening and are quick, they will save a few bucks. Yeah. And speaking of conferences, Niels, you and I, we are both members of the Frontiers organization, which is a group of front-end developers from the Netherlands that used to organize also the Frontiers conference. That's what everybody knows under the term Frontiers, but that's Frontiers conference. Then there's Frontiers organization. And, so COVID also made us all pause these conferences, and we started doing these again, but in another kind of way. So, unfortunately, we can't do them as big as we used to do them back in the days. Maybe someday again.
Maybe someday, but the conference that we're putting on this year, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be in Dordrecht in a theater on October 2nd, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And it's going to be an evening conference. Like we start in the afternoon and go throughout the whole evening with five amazing speakers, and we'll have dinner together and
like proper dinner with a two course dinner in a restaurant that's included in the ticket price. Ticket price is €99. For Frontiers members, it's even less. So, do we want to like leak a few speakers already?
Well, we could talk about a couple of the speakers,
because we haven't like officially we haven't published anything about the speakers yet.
So I can tell you that Sid Stumpel is going to be there, which does amazing work with CSS and animations, and I just love her stuff, and we're so lucky to have her. And Hayden Pickering is going to be there as well, which, well, if you have seen his, if you haven't seen his web briefs yet, you should check that out. That it's just so funny and so to the point, and I love that as well.
And then we also have Harry Roberts.
Yeah.
He might do a rant about our state of web development. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Yep.
There's still a few months to go. Maybe he changes minds. And then who else? So we have like our MC will be Jake Archibald.
Yep.
And we have two more speakers. Like, so it's very probably Anjana Vakil will do some stuff with web audio. So we basically already have like her okay. She also, she said, yeah, I'm going to be part. And then there's like a last speaker that we still have to, so we have somebody in mind, and but we haven't got a yes yet.
It's going to be a good conference either way. It's I'm so looking forward to it.
We'll link to it from our show notes as well as to the CSS Day conference. And yeah, looking forward to seeing as many of you listeners as possible at both of the conferences.
Also a good place to ask you, Niels, any questions related to your projects that you talked about today.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk to anybody just at CSS Day. Just come up to me and I'll happily explain how I build stuff. And it's going to be some code. So fun. Yeah.
Awesome.
Cool. So, thank you for taking the time and visiting us, being here, chatting with us about all the things you do. It was fantastic. We'll try. So your talk from Beyond Tolerant isn't yet published. So if that's going to be the case, then we'll also put it in our show notes. So everyone that listened, thank you as well. If you liked the episode, give us a thumb up. Looking forward to seeing as many of you as possible, and also you, Niels, at the Bespoke conferences.
Thank you for having me, and looking forward to seeing you again at CSSA.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your time. Thanks to the listeners for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.